This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new novel, The Death of Vishnu, asks many questions about what is human and what is divine, and why some people have faith in God and others cannot. The novel is set in a Bombay apartment building inhabited by Hindu families and one Muslim family. A homeless man named Vishnu lives on the landing of the stairs. The review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review described The Death of Vishnu as a beguiling and deceptively ambitious novel. An excerpt of the novel was published in The New Yorker. It's the first novel by my guest Minil Suri. He was born in Bombay in 1959 and grew up there in an apartment building very similar to the one in his novel. He came to the U.S. to study at the age of 20. He's a professor of mathematics at the University of Maryland. Let's start with a reading from the opening of The Death of Vishnu.
Not wanting to arouse Vishnu in case he hadn't died yet, Mrs. Asrani tiptoed down to the third step above the landing on which he lived, tea kettle in hand. Vishnu lay sprawled on the stone, his figure aligned with the curve of the stairs. The laces of a pair of sneakers twined around the fingers of one hand, the other lay outstretched as if trying to pull his body up the next step. During the night, Mrs. Asrani noted with distress, Vishnu had not only thrown up, but also soiled himself. She had warned her neighbor, Mrs. Pathak, not to feed Vishnu when he was so sick, but did that woman ever listen? She tried not to look at the large stain spreading through the worn material of Vishnu's khaki pants, the ones that her husband had given him last Diwali. What a mess! The Jamardarni would have to be brought in to clean up such a mess, and it would not be free either. Someone would have to pay. Her large frame heaving against the sari in which it was swaddled, Mrs. Asrani peered at Vishnu from the safety of the third step and vowed it would not be her.
That's Minil Suri reading from his new novel, The Death of Vishnu. Would you describe the character of Vishnu who's living on the landing of the staircase in this apartment building?
Yeah, Vishnu was a real person, I should say, in the beginning. He was someone who was a fixture of my childhood. He would always be on the stairs. He lived on this landing between the ground and the first floor. And he would always say salam to me. He would often be drunk. He would run errands for people in the building, and you couldn't pay him too much because he would just spend it on drinks.
Now, was this kind of typical in apartment buildings in Bombay where you grew up, that someone would be living in the landing of the staircase?
Yes, it was. Space is at such a premium in Bombay that every little scrap of space is important. Someone like Vishnu would be better off than someone truly on the street where the monsoons would rain down upon them.
So, and was it also typical that they would do odd jobs in return for living on that staircase?
It was more like they did the jobs for the inhabitants and were paid for that. And what happened was that there was this symbiosis between them because the people lived on the stairs, and as a result, people, robbers, could not come up and rob the apartments. And, of course, they performed errands for the inhabitants as well. And in return, they got shelter and sometimes food and money.
Now, your book is in part about the death of this character. How did the real Vishnu die?
Well, I went back home in 94, and Vishnu was very sick, and he was on the steps, and I remember someone left a cup of tea for him, and that was untouched. And I was actually not well that time. I had chicken pox, and my mother started giving me reports about his condition, and it only took about 2 days or something, and she was telling me that the police just came and took his body away.
Now, the main character in your novel is named Vishnu, and that's the same name as the god Vishnu. What is he the god of?
He's the god of preservation. Vishnu is the caretaker of the universe. And it was very interesting when I started this. I started it as a short story, and I wrote the first chapter, and didn't really even think that there's a similarity between Vishnu, the caretaker of the building, and Vishnu, the preserver of the universe. And someone pointed out to me, wait a second, you can't write a story, have your main character named Vishnu, and not say anything about the god Vishnu. I didn't know that much about Hindu mythology. I didn't know that much. I hadn't read the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. So I started looking at these things and trying to see if there were any dramatic possibilities in them, which could somehow be woven into the story.
Now, you were brought up Hindu, even though you thought of yourself as an agnostic. Did your parents, were your parents religious?
My father is a very religious Hindu. He actually makes sure that he goes to a church and a mosque and everything to cover all bases. My mother is actually a Sikh. I was brought up Hindu, and then I think, I forget if I was 14 or 15 or 16 or older, but I decided I had to rebel somehow. So religion was one way that I did it, and I just said, I'm going to become an atheist. And then perhaps the mathematician in me said, well, that's not quite fair. Maybe that's too harsh, so let's be an agnostic. That's that tempers things a little. And that's how I came to writing this novel. At that stage, I was an agnostic. And reading these texts was initially a purely intellectual exercise.
And it became something else?
It did, I think. I just feel that my life has changed in many ways. Just the kinds of goals that one tries to aspire towards and the ideals that one has, they have changed.
How?
Well, I'll give you one example. Before reading the Bhagavad Gita, I was very obsessed with getting published. I had tried for many years, and the only thing I had to show for that was one very short thing called The Tyranny of Vegetables, and that too was in Bulgarian. It wasn't even in English, and I couldn't show it to anyone. I didn't even know the name of the journal it was in because I couldn't read it. It was in Cyrillic. So after that, after reading this, I just sort of said, well, wait a second. I've been sending things out, and I've got 50 or 60 rejection letters. Let me just work on this, which is very enjoyable, work on this novel and try to finish it and not worry about what happens afterwards.
Now, the cliche would be that the math part of your personality is the very rational part, and the writer part of your personality is the more intuitive, dreamy part. Would that just be a cliche, or is there any truth to that?
I think in math, too, you have to let your mind sort of wander. When I am trying to prove a theorem, for instance, I really have to let go and just let my mind float around and try to maybe even rifle through all the theorems or all the results that I've seen. And it's almost by fluke that sometimes you happen to come upon the right thing. And that process is similar in writing, where you just let your mind wander again and try to come up with characters or situations or ways to resolve different settings.
Now, you're doing that kind of high-level math that most people who aren't mathematicians can't really understand. Can you tell us something that will give us an insight into the kind of math that you do?
Oh, I'd be happy to fill the rest of the hour with that, if you'd like. I keep threatening people in the publishing business that I'm going to give them a lecture complete with slides and everything. And no one's taken me up on my offer yet. But the kind of math that I do is very applied. I work with engineers. Engineers, especially in mechanical engineering or structural analysis, often come up with very complicated sets of equations, which they need to solve to make sure that the components they're designing are strong enough to withstand stresses. And what my field does is it looks at the methods of approximating these equations that these engineers come up with, abstracts them, and analyzes them to see if they do work, in all possible settings, and gives them some sort of reassurance or validation that their methods are accurate, or if they're not accurate, what kinds of errors they can get. It's called numerical analysis.
Now, is it a relief in a way to work in literature where, like, the worst thing that can go wrong is that it's dull, but there isn't going to be, like, a building that collapses?
Well, mathematicians like to claim that everything revolves around them, that if some disaster occurs, it's due to the mathematician, but it's usually the engineer who has to shoulder that responsibility. So there is quite a bit of freedom in the abstractions that mathematicians play with. So that wasn't so much of the relief. The relief was that you have much fewer constraints in fiction. You can really take your characters anywhere, pretty much. I mean, you can define them to be anything. In mathematics, since I do applied mathematics, I do have to look at the physical problem and obey the laws of physics, and I'm constrained in that way. There is a branch of mathematics called pure mathematics where, again, people start with some assumptions and then just build a theory based on that.
Okay. Well, that's enough about the math, isn't it?
Well, I don't think so.
My guest is Manil Suri. His new novel is called The Death of Vishnu. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Manil Suri, and he's a mathematician and writer. His first novel has just been published to excellent reviews. It's called The Death of Vishnu. Now, one of the characters in your novel bases her romantic fantasies on Indian movies. Your father worked for Indian movies, or maybe still does. What kind of work does he do, or did he do?
Well, he's retired now, but he was an assistant to a music director. The Indian movies I'm talking about are called Bollywood films or masala films. Masala is the mixture of spices you find in Indian food. And these movies are also a mixture of various plot elements. There's always 6 or 7 or 8 or now even 14 songs and dances. There's fights and there is a villain and there's comedy and there's a lot of romance. And there has to be at least some tragedy so that you can pull out your handkerchief.
And it's all pretty broad.
It's broad, but it's also, in some ways, reassuringly predictable. You know what's going to happen, and the audience is waiting for these things, and they enjoy it immensely. And it's unfortunate that in this country, only the art films from India are usually available. These films are very entertaining, and the character in my book that you mentioned, Kavita, she's completely enthralled by them, and she really thinks of herself as the heroine of a Hindi movie.
And is there any like particular fantasy that you have that you think really comes out of the movies that you grew up with?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that not just I, but maybe a number of people in India would think about that are derived from the movies. I think movies are really a common thread that binds together society or runs through society there. If I'd asked the real Vishnu about movies, he would probably know the names of actors and so on. I did try to put myself in the place of Kavita and think about, well, what fantasies could I engineer in her head? And the one that I came up with is a well-known plot element that she falls in love with a Muslim boy. She's Hindu. And this always causes problems. And there's a famous line in movies, in Hindi movies, this marriage cannot take place. And I managed to squeeze that into the book as well.
What were the popular books that your generation read?
While I was growing up, people did not buy books that much. They're very expensive in India. What people did was go to circulating libraries, which are much like video circulating libraries here. And so you rented out books. As a result, you only had a limited selection, and that was mostly bestseller related. So there were many, many volumes by Harold Robbins or Arthur Haley or best-selling authors like that. There used to be a British writer who's not very well known here, a crime-type writer called James Hadley Chase, and that was one of the books that I remember in school we used to read secretly because they were kind of banned. They were considered very bad for us to read.
Would you describe the neighborhood that you grew up in Bombay?
Well, I grew up in I grew up in one room of a large apartment, and we were the only Hindu family. There were 3 Muslim families living in different rooms of this apartment. We shared a kitchen with one family. There were some common toilets at the end of the flat. My parents still lived there, so a few weeks ago when I went back, that's where I stayed. Downstairs, there's a whole bunch of shops, which have changed somewhat over the years. While I was growing up, there was a panwala. Pan is this betel nut confection. There was a cigarette wala, a man who sells cigarettes. The cigarette wala now has expanded his tiny stall into a giant store. And he's even torn down the wall behind the landing where Vishnu lived and somehow managed to find a way to get into his storeroom that way. And then there used to be a shop that rented out bicycles, which now sells cellular phones.
So you and your parents shared one room?
Yes, we did. It was a large room, but it was shared. And people sometimes ask me if I could have written this book in India, and it would have been very difficult because that's where I might still be staying, and there would still be the fights with the neighbors and so on.
What kind of privacy did you or your parents have sharing one room together?
Not much. And every time I go back, it's quite startling because in Maryland, I live in this house, and, you know, there are two bathrooms, and I have my own room and everything. And then I'm somehow deposited in this, really, it's like a fishbowl because my parents haven't seen me for a while, and they're just always talking to me and so on, which is great, but certainly privacy is not what I go back for.
What kind of conflicts did your family have with the other families that I share the apartment with?
Oh, just about every kind. You name it. It's just so hard to have a common kitchen. The further complication was that family was actually the landlord of the entire apartment, so we couldn't really... we always had this worry that, well, will we be evicted or something like that? So they were the ones that I remember are there used to be one tank that would feed water to all the families, and that tank usually ran out by noontime or something, and so there were always accusations of the form, well, you took an extra bath. No, you did, and things like that.
You moved to America in 1979 to go to college. You were 20 at the time. What were your first impressions of America? What did you find most wonderful and most disturbing about it?
Well, the first thing I wanted to do was eat a Big Mac.
Why? What did you hear about it?
I'd just seen so much about it, and I, you know, went down to the McDonald's and ordered my first Big Mac, and it was great saying everything on it. And it was awful. It was horrible. I couldn't believe it. So in some ways, I thought that I knew pretty much everything about America because I'd seen so many Hollywood films. I'd read so many books. I'd read Mad Magazine. I'd read Archie Comics. And so it was all very familiar, actually. And I just felt myself fitting in. I didn't like Big Macs, I found out, but so what?
What were the movies that really formed your impressions of America before you got here?
Oh, there were too many to relate. I'd had a steady diet of them for I don't know how many years. What was interesting was when I came here, there were all these movies that had been banned in India. So for the first year or so, I was just catching up, like Last Tango in Paris and even the uncensored Godfather. And there were just so many movies.
Was there much sex or violence in Indian cinema?
No, not at all. In fact, the classical thing is that up till recently, in Indian movies, when two people wanted to kiss, when the hero kissed the heroine, they ducked behind a tree so that you wouldn't see them kissing. And then they came out sort of wiping their lips to show that they had just kissed.
Now, how did that approach to... not showing any kind of physical encounter affect your approach to writing your novel?
Oh, well, I had to do just the opposite. I had to make sure that I had lots of sex and so on. And it was interesting because I read out parts of this in Bombay where the book was released in January. And my family was in the audience. So I made it a point to read out the sex scenes and watch them squirm.
And they squirmed, huh?
Oh, yes. Not just them, but the whole audience.
Manil Suri, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Manil Suri is the author of the new novel, The Death of Vishnu. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.